leaders. What keeps you up at night? Welcome to The Sweet Spot, the podcast series that expands the traditional term of what a boss is to tackle some of the most important issues in business. From business as usual and growing your market to everyday leadership issues or handling one in 100 year events, we aim to provide ongoing inspiration and education for CEOs, founders, management, shareholders, and leaders of every stripe. The Sweet Spot is the future of work and business.
In the wake of global turmoil and growing pressure on individuals and companies alike, the team at Alexander PR developed a new white paper to help identify red flags before they can turn into an issue or crisis. We worked with a number of global leaders, directors, and experts to distill the top 23 bad habits directors and leaders need to be aware of in 2023. In today's conversation, Dwayne Alexander and I, Emily Svatanak, speak to one of these contributors, Dr. John Peebles. John has been a professional director, board advisor, and executive search consultant for almost four decades. He has served as director and chair for a number of state-owned enterprises, private companies, and not-for-profits, and was recognized as one of the top 50 most influential global headhunters by Newsweek USA in 2008. Dr. Peebles' thesis in his doctoral study was Power and Influences on the Board's Agenda, Who Determines What Corporate Directors Discuss? He is also the author of Parsley on Fish, or How Corporate Directors Can Learn to Be More Than Decorative. Welcome, Dr. John Peebles. Thank you for joining us today, John.
You're very welcome.
Hi, John.
Hi.
John, you're a professional director and chairman of a number of boards. You also were in the top 50 most influential global headhunters by Newsweek and USA. Tell us what, in your experience, are some of the pain points around boards, selection, CEOs, and the dynamics with chair people as well.
Boards can have preconceived ideas about who they have on, and often they don't do a proper cultural review or skill review, and halfway through a search, they can also tell you this is the person they want to appoint, and you've immediately got a disaster on your hands. And the problem also is that they've sometimes don't even check them. And at a board level particularly, it's a regime of no surprises. So there needs to be really conscious checking. Even at the level of board directors, we would get qualifications that are non-existent in the real sense. They're just not there, and people claim they have them. So there's that, and then the checking back. In any checking back on an appointment, not only does the consultant or whoever's doing the search have to do that, but the chair should check with previous boards on two things: cultural fit and whether the individual, particularly if they've come from an executive role, can step up and leave the executive role behind and transition to governance.
Mm. And you also do a board review. Can you explain to us what the board review entails?
It's actually quite an interesting process. They vary company on company, but the process that we would run involves about an 8-page questionnaire, and it looks at every aspect of board operation, and it asks people to grade them. And we send that out in confidence after briefing each of the board members, and we get the reply back in confidence, and then we collate it all into one document, and we can see where the weaknesses are perceived by the majority of the board, and where the strengths are perceived by the majority of the board. And then we go and interview each of the individuals personally and talk to them about some of those strengths and weaknesses. And at the end of that, we'll then write a report. Now, the actual questionnaires never leave the hand of the consultant, and they're not talked about as individual things. What you talk about is a collaborative, collective type
thing. So it's aggregated.
It's aggregated, yes. And you have space on the bottom for questions or comments. And, boy, you get a few of those. And generally, you can see the pressure points straight away. And once you start talking to the directors, you'll also get that fairly quickly. Often it's about personality differences on the board. Mm. Sometimes it'll be about differences with management or chief financial officer or dissatisfaction with their performance, but no one's ever sat down and talked to them about it. It's really quite fascinating. And then you write the report, and then they come back to you and tell you what they think's wrong with it, of course, which is always interesting. And you go along and talk to the board and chat to them about things they could do to improve it. So there's generally a set of the recommendations that come out of it. Mm. The two we've done recently, time-consuming, but really only 3 or 4 points to argue with at the end of it. One of the ones that came out of the last one I did was a strategy concept. We were looking at the company saying, where do you take it? And they all had different ideas.
So growth, right?
Where do you go? Where's your future? And we came back and said, well, there's only one question here and here it is, and you should go away as a board and talk about it because we think it's a major problem for the company going forward. So sometimes it takes that outside view to look at it and say, guys, these are things you need to consider.
What are the conditions that have to happen in order for a board review to happen? So what triggers it? Who asks for a board review in general?
Generally, you'll either get a dissatisfied director who says, I'm not happy with the way this process is going on. Just been through one of those. They didn't like the compensation process, so he asked for it to be reviewed. And we reviewed it. And look, it was a good process, but it wasn't a superb process. And what we had to do was say, if you really want a superb process, this is what you need to do. And here's an example of how you need to handle it. And we took them through that and then made some commentary on other things on the way through, like where their compensation was positioned, what more information they needed to get to make sure they had enough comparator data, that sort of stuff. So that's pretty much the sort of thing you get with it. Occasionally you'll get a director or a board just saying, it's routine for us every 3 years to review our board processes, and we're going to do one this there or the next year. And in fact, most boards, and certainly the ones I chair, would have a list of potential risks, and you would normally do a deep dive every now and then into a subject, and sometimes you'll recognise you don't have the data to do a deep dive, so you call someone in to provide that data, and then you have a good look at it, and that should be an outside person.
I'd like to take a step back now and actually go at it from a new director coming into an organisation. So you might have a process for those regular reviews, you might not. But from an outsider's view, a new incoming director, what are the top questions someone should be asking as they come into an organisation?
Well, it goes without saying that you'd be looking at annual reports and financials and probably want a one-on-one session with the chief financial officer. And you'd probably want to meet the chief executive as well, decide whether you liked him and you thought he was any good. But on top of that, you would go through the last, say, 6 months of board papers, looking at issues that they've got, seeing what actions they've taken and how they've actually handled those, and seeing if there's any factions in there or fights or disagreements over certain stuff. I think if you then go from that and you say, I'm satisfied with that, you'd look at the individuals on the board. Particularly, I'd be looking at the style of the chairman and how he handled the process, and it comes back again to process. It's all about process. Does he run a good process here? Can he flex something? Can he take up an issue? Often in a board meeting, and this is seems strange, but you'll be discussing someone and someone will make a remark that's a bit sideways. You know,
flippant comment.
Think about this, and everyone will ignore it. Well, a good chairman won't ignore it. He'll say, let's just pick that up and come back to it as a discussion point, because there's no – first things are, if you've read the board papers, there are no stupid questions, and often stupid questions lead to really good debates. And so it's really important for the chairman to be on top of that, to know when to cut things off and when to open things up. And that's, again, about good process and good chairmanship. So the chairman is actually quite crucial and often elected on service rather than necessary ability.
So communication skills.
All communicate. Boards are all about communication. I don't care what you say. Boards are all communication. Shareholders, stakeholders, bless them, even though they don't have a financial stake in the business. The board itself, can we communicate with one another? Some of them don't. You'd be staggered. And then management, do we talk freely to management?
Yeah.
Do we even go and meet management? I mean, I've just gone through one where the chief exec got upset because the chairman wanted to go and actually talk to some of the staff. I mean, for God's sake, he'll learn a lot about the company by walking the floor. And if you saw one of our big prominent public companies a while ago with directors saying they didn't know something was happening under their feet, they should have. And you can find all sorts of things by walking around and talking to someone, whether it's the storm and the cleaner. You'll be surprised what they'll tell you. And it's not on the chief executive's list to be told.
And John, you've got an opinion about strategy and who does it. Whether it's management or the board, tell us about that.
Strategy, at board level is macro strategy. And research, and certainly that for my doctorate, showed that the four things the board needed to worry about were strategy, first and foremost, and that's macro strategy. They need to look at risk, and they need to look at performance and control it. And finally, everyone says they can do that, and they can't. And the final figure is they need also to hire a chief executive because he's their only officer. So they need to know something about people. If you look at strategy, boards should do the macro strategy. Generally, what I find is that boards don't know how to handle a strategy session, so they throw it to the chief executive, ask him to write the strategy, and then they kick the stink out of it. And in fact, really what the board should do is sit down, write the macro strategy themselves on one page, starting with visions and values, no more than three or four objectives for years, all you can handle, quarterly report, who's going to do it by when, and quarterly we want to see whether it's been done. And you write that small strategy that someone can read and keep handy. If you go beyond four pages, you're breaking the rules. Some of them do 30 pages. No one's going to read it. Mm-hmm. Forget it. So strategy at macro level by a board. The chief executive can write how many pages he wants, but board and the reporting for that on strategy, four pages max. One page would have everything on it.
You talked about planning and making a list of the risks involved as well as part of the board review. In terms of setting the strategy and having the macro view, how does crisis planning and communication come into that?
Well, the risk matrix, which should be on every board agenda and it should be on every meeting, and you should review one aspect of it every time during the year. So on Tuesday morning, I went through our risk strategy and I said, we've just been through this a month ago. We've ticked off the stuff we're quite happy, but we are also going to re-look at our IT security this year. We've only just done it, but it's moving so fast, I think we need to look at it again because we're holding a lot of confidential information. But that risk thing should be on every board meeting every day, and that should be a conversation that you have, one particular area, but you have a conversation on it, and that does fit into the way you look at your board papers. It's got to. And the chief executive and the chief financial officer should be involved in that discussion.
It's interesting, John, because often the CEO is in the firing line or in the front line and seen as responsible when things go very, very wrong. Right. But often it's the board and setting up of the structure behind that that may have a failing in it.
Have you ever seen a board fire itself?
No.
Not in my knowledge, and I've been at this for 40 years. So I've seen the odd chairman step down. New Zealand boards do not, the directors, New Zealand boards and directors do not accept responsibility and step down when things go wrong easily. They do not do it easily. Overseas, it's probably more common. But something goes wrong, the board is the people, they're the people at the top. Mm. And they're the people who should step down if it goes wrong. Mm. Not all in one go, preferably. Yeah. You want to keep them going so you knew what was going on.
So how do you think one can bring in new directors, a new generation of directors? What skills, what would help progress that?
Well, that evaluation I spoke to, those evaluations, talk about the skill sets as well. They go through the skill sets and they ask the director not only to rank his own skill sets but to rank the skill sets of the others. So you can see the weakness areas in the perception of the board anyway, and then the consultant looking at it from outside will say, hang on a minute, I don't see this, this, or this. So the last one I did, I said, we're short on marketing, and by the way, your age has got everyone tipped over here, and we need to think about these things. And then we actually wrote a thing saying, you should lose this person immediately and replace them. And by the way, this person's competent as an advisor, but is on the staff and shouldn't be. Okay, and so we'll move you across, keep you as an advisor but not as a director. And then we also need someone who does this and this, and we need you to think of younger people with different skills coming in, particularly in the case of this one, it was marketing and international sales that we were looking at.
You have quite a structured approach to these conversations, to strategy, to what needs to happen in terms of the process.
Right.
What happens if you have a board and you have external advice and there are conflicting opinions on how to handle a matter?
Well, they'll generally take no notice of you at all, which is what does happen from time to time. And the other problem is that there are I always used to think that boards were equal and democratic. They're not. There are cliques within boards and they are power groups. And if they don't like something, they'll take care of it. So many a report is banished into the file under W without being seen when it needed to be seen. And often reports have been written before and never changed. I remember writing one report for a former prime minister and going down, spending an hour, 20 minutes telling him what we should do. And he agreed it was the best report he'd ever seen on the subject, then put it in the drawer. And I asked what he was going to do. He said, absolutely nothing. And I said, why not? He said, there's no mileage in fiddling with this. Mm. Now, so sometimes pragmatic reasoning will take over from what is good practice. And that comes back again, good process. In good process, should we put this on the table and debate it? Yes, we should. Do we? That might be another thing altogether.
Mm. You often speak about ethics in amongst the board and the right thing to do. But is there a situation where directors meet outside of the board and try to influence other directors? Does that happen in real life?
It happens in real life occasionally, and that's up to the chairman to sort it out. Mm. But I think the one thing, every board should have a code of ethics and a set of values.
Yeah.
And you don't breach them. You breach them at your peril. It's really interesting where you might get someone saying to you, we want to use those security cameras to observe some employees, right? That's a no-no.
Illegal.
Absolutely a no-no. Mm. Just please don't bring that up again.
Yeah.
It's that, you know, how would you like it if they put the security camera on our boardroom?
John, also looking at appointment to boards and when you're getting a brief to hire a director, what are the common traits that are sought after?
I think if you look at it, I find boards are very good at giving you a job description, but not very good at telling you what they want in outcomes from the person they're putting on. So what sort of skill sets do we really want and why? And boards don't think that through. They give you the job description, the person's specifications, they go out and find them. Well, what do you want him to do? If you tell me what he wants, what you want him to do, I can tell you whether I think he can do it. Mm-hmm. But they go about it the wrong way because they'll hire on the job description and fire on the outputs. But in any board, the chairman's job, quite firmly the chairman's job, is to consider the three G's. You're here to get, give, or get off. And once a year, as chairman, I'm going to have coffee with you and discuss all three options. Now, you don't need a consultant to tell you how to evaluate your board. You just need to sit down with the person and say, I want that coffee with you. You'll know immediately, or she will know immediately, you're here to talk about what I got for you, what I gave to you, or maybe it's time I got off.
Mm.
And you make that clear. You repeat it again and again and again because sometimes you should be able to look back at it. The chairman's role also is really important in this because sometimes also you'll get a director approach you saying, so-and-so as a director does nothing. And I've had that happen a few times. And I'll say, well, hang on a minute. What do you mean does nothing? Well, he never asks questions at a board meeting. He never does, or she never does this.
Mm.
And I've said, particularly the last one I remember, then you obviously haven't followed what the chief executive's doing because he rang me and asked if he could go and talk with the chief executive. The two have been working on this particular project, which has been coming to your table.
So what are the metrics, right? What are you evaluating?
Mm. Absolutely. Have you covered off what this person's real contribution is? But you're looking for a contribution. And you're looking for contribution, but you're looking for a seamlessness in function and action with management. If your board doesn't work seamlessly with management, you've got it wrong.
When is the situation when the board is getting involved too much in operations? Is that a thing?
Oh, yes, particularly individual directors, particularly those who've stepped out of a CEO role, switch across into a board career. They say it's a board career, and they can't leave the detail alone. Forget it. As my old boss once said, the hardest thing is to appoint someone to do a job and then let him do it his way. You just got to step back and let it get on with it. The results are what's important for you, not the process of doing it or all the minor detail. Does it really matter if $5 goes on doing X, Y, Z? Who cares? In the big picture, you want to know the nearest million. Mm. You're not really interested in the $5. And it doesn't mean you're discarding detail. It just means you don't need to get into it.
Mm. What are skills that directors need to have? What are nice to haves, and what are areas that you most often see when you do these board reports and board audits? What are the areas that directors should be upskilling at to become more effective?
Right. What do they need? Strategy, risk, and financial management all need numbers ability. And do you know, in the surveys we've done both here and the ones I did in Stanford, we only got 32 to 35% of the directors surveyed with a pass in financial literacy, which means half, maybe, yeah, a third of the directors can read your reports, and probably only 10% of that can actually manipulate the stuff. So they're really short on financial literacy, and it's absolutely, they say that we know a lot about people who can do this. Financial literacy is essential for all the key aspects, so it has to be good. It's one of the reasons most boards will pick the majority of their CEOs from finance, because it gives them a comfort zone. But you need to have finance there, particularly to be able to trumble the numbers and work on it, to see alternatives, and to talk to people about it. If you don't have that, you're lacking. So finance is one of the high-level skills. If you haven't got it and you want to be a director, then you go and you work out how you're going to get it. Marketing's useful to have, but I wouldn't expect people to be marketing gurus. If you actually look at real life in an organisation, 14% have got some exposure to marketing, 71% counting in finance, and then operations is it's a bit at the end. So there's not too many operational directors on the end. And you might say to me, IT people, why are petrified? People are petrified of IT. Well, it never delivers what it says it's going to do. It never comes in on budget. And it always overpromises, and you know, it's just hopeless. So most boards are suspicious of IT people, so they don't take them on.
Fascinating. How does communication come into that? Because we talked a lot about how directors need to be good at communicating, but it isn't actually an essential skill.
I disagree. It's an absolutely essential skill, both written and verbal communication. When you're beyond top management, over 60% of your task is communicating in writing or speaking. And if those directors can't stand up and talk on a stage at an annual general meeting, you should be asking why they're there. And so you really need them to be able to communicate effectively. It might be their area of expertise, but they should be able to get up and give a really authoritative view on it. They should be a guru in their functional area, but they should be able to talk and very easily talk if they can. And communication particularly goes to the person on the floor. So you've got to be able to lean over and talk to the cleaner as you go past. I passed one of our cleaners the other day and commented on her tattoo and said, that's really interesting. Where did she get that from? And she told me it was someplace in South America. Now, you know, the chairman's got to be able to lean over and talk to those people. So because that person will go away and have morning tea, you might only have seen that person once, and they'll say to their friends, do you know, I had a good chat with the chairman today. Well, it didn't probably, but at least they feel they've been communicated with. Mm. And to them, it's a big deal that someone recognises you, talks to you, asks your opinion. You know, if you want to know where the lead's going missing from or your TVs are going missing from the cart dock, just ask the carriers or the warehouseman. If they don't tell you, they're probably stealing it. But you know,
it's about institutional knowledge.
It is, and you walk through the place, you'll get that knowledge.
It's interesting what you say about communication, because we're part of the public relations global network, which is in 50 plus markets across the world. And we ask them for some of the common mistakes that boards make, because we deal with a lot of CEOs, C-suite boards and directors. And we were fascinated by the amount of, you know, common bad habits that these boards have. We had to whittle it down to 23. Right. And out of that, a lot of them were around communication. And John, you've read the 23 bad habits. Are there any that resonate to you in particular?
I think if I worry about it, it would be when the crisis does actually arise. And, you know, when the crisis arises, you should have that HR or that communications person sitting there. They should be talking to you about it, saying, if such and such happens, this is what we should be doing. There should be discussion about it and agreement on which way it's heading. And there should be someone who is also capable of saying to you, I don't like that. If you do that, this will happen. We should ignore this or do this or focus on that. Let's focus on the good things. But, you know, you might remember a few years ago we had a power outage in Auckland. All the power went out right through the city, and it swamped us. We were knocked out for about 6 or 10 weeks. Now, people know that things go wrong. It goes wrong in their lives too. But if you accept that and apologize, don't have to accept liability, but if you apologize and if you say, this is what we plan to do to fix it, you'll be given space to fix it. You can recall a product that's gone wrong and you'll be given space. You can ruin a brand by trying to defend it when it has gone wrong.
And it's not always what happens to you, it's how you respond.
It's right? How you respond. I think there's some really classic lessons you could point to. I was thinking of one air crash particularly where a disaster plan, which all companies should have, was pulled out by the chief executive who'd been there a week because we'd appointed him. And he stood by this crashed airplane where people had died and told the public on television what he was planning on doing about certain things and what they thought of it and how they would handle it. And it was brilliant. Mm. And people were ringing up saying, isn't this a wonderful airline? That just killed someone. I mean, it's the way in which you handle it. But there was an empathy there for the people. There was something that allowed them to connect with the people, and the people gave them space to fix it.
We are often in conversations with clients in the same room as a lawyer because it's prudent when you're dealing with very significant risk elements that you involve your lawyer. Not every single conversation goes our way in terms of accepting liability and communicating with key target audiences. What is your opinion about when to bring your lawyer in and when to listen and when not to?
Kick him out. I would say simply to you, get your strategy right before you bring the lawyers in. The lawyers are there to look after your liability. Saying sorry doesn't mean you accept liability. It means I'm sorry this thing occurred. Liability is another thing altogether. But saying sorry is something you can't escape from. And if you listen to any court case going, whether it's criminal or civil, the people who apologise in the dock are the people you have an empathy for. Mm.
The one question that we didn't really talk about is at what point do boards need to bring in outside expert advice?
They should probably think about it where they don't have the expertise sitting around the table. And they should probably think about if they need to counter a strong view around the table which claims expertise. Now, a good example would be, and a good example for most boards don't have IT specialists. They really don't. And therefore, if you look at that, as we were doing recently, what's our IT security? We're holding information on all these people, their health records, all sorts of things. How do we handle this? And are we secure? So we called in an expert group who's specialist as to look at that, and they gave us some things with traffic lights, and there were so many red signs on it, I was absolutely horrified. And it cost us a few bob, put it, it stunned everybody. It was a good impartial outside view. We thought we were in pretty good shape. We realized we weren't, and we had to rectify it. It actually was quite interesting because the board's focus for nearly the next year was the progress as we started to rectify that. What's interesting is that the board's focus has spun back to that a year later saying, are we still there? Has it changed? And they're worried about the speed with which this thing changes. So, yes, it's essential to have it in. But sometimes it's just essential because you will look at a market and say to someone, you've got a wonderful market over here and all your product's going to it. It's going to one country, it's going to one thing, and that's your entire market, and look how successful you are. And then someone like me comes along and says, that's fine, what's your backup plan? If that market falls away tomorrow, what are you going to do? Go out of business? Mm. You need to think in your strategy about where to. Mm. Where are we going in the next 10 years? Now, it doesn't mean you're going to change direction tomorrow, but it does mean you're going to start developing your direction. Good example in the US would have been people starting to move to online shopping, right, from the supermarket more to online shopping. Why did Amazon buy one of the biggest retail groups in America? They bought it because it has a lot of real estate, has a lot of customers, and if you look at the growth in the online, it's huge, but it's a tiny portion of the total sales, but it's going to get bigger. And we're going to see it get bigger. And what's stopping it getting bigger? Probably electric cars without a driver that can bring your groceries to your door, and a storage fridge that someone can access outside without getting into the house that keeps the product cool. So once we've got that, hey, would you be buzzing going into the supermarket or would you rather do it online? So we're going to see a huge growth in the online, a huge transition of IT, and it will go over the top and then snowball rapidly. It will change the way we think about it. Amazon also liked this retail group because when they bought this retail group, which was one of the biggest, they also got a lot of land, which had supermarkets on it and parking areas. Mm. Now, what do you do with supermarkets and parking areas? You no longer need them. Mm. You sell the land off, make a buck out of it. So it's a great asset. So you can actually see the things happening inside that. very, very useful.
Thank you, John. My final question is around change. You've been a professional director for quite a number of years, won't say how many, but if you had to give your young self a bit of advice as a new director, what would you say to that director now?
I'd probably say to him, look, I once heard a wonderful director in Australia, Alan Coates, who'd been on several major boards, and we went through a day where we were dissecting a major crisis and what had gone wrong. And there were judges and judiciary people and everyone there. And we were going through this, and Alan sat patiently at the front row listening to it all. And when he was asked to close the comments, he got up and he said, look, I'm just a simple director. And when I get up from a board table, I hope like hell that half the decisions I've made are right with the information I've got. He said, 3 months later, if I look at them again, I hope that 25% of them are right. I don't want to look after that.
Yeah.
And I think the thing you've got to do is you've got to remember you do the best you can with the information. You should be well-equipped, well-prepared for it, but you do the best with what you have, but you have to be prepared to change it and, live with change, live with criticism, deal with it. You can't be fixated on something. And long-term planning is probably 6 months today.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Please like, review, or share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. If you'd like to follow us, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn under Alexander PR, or follow the links in the show notes below. Until next time, thank you for listening.